the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history. And
good morning, afternoon, evening, or late night to all of our listeners in whatever time zone it is you may be drifting through. You are now tuned into Sake On Air, the world's one and only podcast dedicated entirely to the world of sake and shochu, broadcast in general bi-weekly from the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center here in Tokyo, Japan. I'm Justin Potts, one of your regular sake navigators for the show, and I'm very excited to be able to share this week's episode. In recent weeks, we've had the opportunity to sit down with some really exciting guests for special events and interviews. And this week is no different. As a matter of fact, in a way, we're stepping up our game and branching out a little bit in two ways for a special two-part episode. For one, we're finally giving some much overdue and well-deserved attention to the world of shochu. We've dabbled in it a little bit up until now, and we have some great shochu-infused discussions that are lined up for the coming weeks, but this is the first shochu-centric discussion that we're really diving into. And what makes this one particularly exciting, however, is that we have a miniature who's who of the bartending, mixology, and cocktail world to sit down with us in order to share their discoveries surrounding Japan's little bit of distilled alchemy that is shochu. We're joined this week by, first, Mr. Thomas Wah, bartender and director of bar operations at Major Food Group in New York. We also welcome Mr. Mike Enright, owner and bartender at Sydney's famous gin bar, The Barbershop. We also have in the studio Mr. Ryan Chetniwardena. He's probably better known to everyone as Mr. Lion. He's the man responsible for White Lion in London, the cocktail bar that shook up the industry when it opened in 2013. And last but certainly not least, we are also joined by Matthew Hunter. He is the head bartender at the renowned 11 Madison Park, the restaurant ranked world's best in the world's 50 best restaurant awards back in 2017. A huge thanks is in order to these gentlemen who were kind enough to join us for a quick chat and a shochu tasting following what was a whirlwind week-long journey throughout Kyushu, Japan's southern island and motherland of shochu. And finally, to top things off this week, we also get into sake. And in order to do that, we travel all the way to France for the second segment. Or shall I say that France comes to us? Right after successfully wrapping up another Salon de Sake in Paris, Sake Samurai and organizer of France's largest celebration of all things sake, Mr. Sylvain Huet, popped in to chat with us during his recent visit to Japan. We catch up with Sylvain on what he's been up to, the evolution of Salon de Sake, and what he's excited about with regards to sake in Paris. So basically, we've got a very packed episode this week. It's at this point where I stop talking and we get on with things. So with that, on to this week's episode of Sake On Air.
Before we get started, real quick, why don't you guys both say your names and what it is you're associated with?
My name is Thomas Wah. I currently live in New York City and I work for Major Food Group, which is a large restaurant group in New York City. We have 12 restaurants. And I'm the director of bar operations. So I curate the menus for cocktails and beer. Not so much wine, but you know, spirits and beer and cocktails is sort of my specialty.
My name is Matthew Hunter. I am the head bartender at 11 Madison Park restaurant. So I just focus behind the bar there. I've worked for the company for close to 5 years now. And yeah, that's pretty much it. So I just kind of oversee the bar and my team and just help with, you know, the beverage, the cocktail menu. Focus on that. Yeah.
Excellent. How was your trip?
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You said it was your first time to Japan. Anything mm-hmm. particularly leave an impression? Or?
I think it's very nice for us to kind of see the aspect of just something so specialized as the shochu production, see the source of the material and then taste it. So you know, you see it, you taste it. It's really great.
Yeah. For me, it was really really special because I've opened to Japanese style restaurants, in New York, and I've always sort of been flying by the seat of my pants. I've done my own research and whatnot, but maybe I didn't know exactly what I was talking about when it comes to Sochu. So to be here and to finally like learn some really like hardcore, like real first, you know, firsthand experience material was just amazing.
Meet the people as well.
And meet the people.
Yeah, the people are so passionate about what it, the culture of like, for us to go and drink Sochu like in a social setting is something very like I've never done it before. So to taste first just the balance of why it's so great with food, and then the social culture of like why, you know, you've got a lower ABV product that you can drink like while you're eating food. It's meant to be consumed with food. You know, and so it's just nice to see that, you know, we're very much Western culture. So, you know, of course we sell spirits and drink wine and drink beer, but for us to see just how versatile the spirit is across the board, it's really been eye-opening for us. And it's a
difficult category because we are, you know, being from the United States, we're used to either drinking beer, which is very low ABV and crushable, or we're drinking like whiskey or something that's a high proof and very concentrated alcohol spirit. And so Sochu is like sits in the middle. So I think it's hard for a lot of people to really wrap their heads around what it should taste like. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, they probably served it up to you in a number of different ways, different styles. There's no quote unquote one right or wrong way. And so
I'm for the most part in the United States, the way that people drink Sochu, when they the rare times that they actually do drink it is on ice. But I found over this throughout this trip that drinking it warm is actually so much better. You really get the flavor it reaches that the flavor zone that you would get from drinking, like say, like a whiskey or something.
So how is Sochu, or, well, I don't know how much you guys got into Awamori at all. You might have a few tastings this evening. Are those things that are in your tool set at all back home, or?
We're really trying to figure out its place because we're in this realm of mixology, but we don't really know how it's going to fit into blending with different spirits that are higher proof. Because we're afraid that we're going to lose a lot of these delicate nuances of the spirit by putting something in. So, and also like diluting it down with ice, because that's the nature of building drinks. It's through dilution that you have your end product. So
it's already diluted, though.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's hard to understand.
Yeah.
Because there's two things about Sochu that's hard to understand for Westerners. That there's no sugar in it. We're used to having a mouthfeel or a body in a spirit or beer or sake, it has sugar, and we're used to tasting sugar and understanding, like our palates understand what sugar tastes like. So there's not that, and then it's already diluted. So you take away sugar and then you add water to it. Now it's really hard to understand our brains. It's hard to understand what this is supposed to taste like because we're not used to tasting diluted, no sugar spirit.
Was there something in particular that kind of created a spark for you, or a keyword, or something that you kind of latched onto that you're excited to take home with you?
I mean, we love the characteristics of umami, like these kind of like rich, kind of like toasted, roasted notes of barley, and the difference between the distillation with black and white koji is very like we like these really kind of like nutty, fatty aromas. And flavors,
yeah,
because
it's savory.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. The two of us and basically the team, you know, we're really kind of that's what inspires us, or what we gravitate towards is like these kind of like richer flavors. So
that's
it
works so well with food, and everyone's like really pushing the envelope on it being. I'll give you an example. Earlier today, we were having lunch and we were just playing a game. What if we had our own distillery, our own Sochu distillery, and what would we do? And how would we approach the market? And we were like, well, who are we going to compete with?
Yeah.
Are we competing with Japanese whiskey? No. Are we competing with the wine industry? No. We're competing with beer. because it's something that is so easy to drink casually while you're having a meal, and it's also something that tastes so good with food. You know, so
you're coming back with ideas to put on your menu already?
We discussed, you know, what we thought, and we're really trying to more focus on expressing the spirit in its 100%, like as it's meant to be enjoyed, instead of like diluting it in the least bit. So, I mean, Thomas brought up an important point. It was kind of like the style of service, where it's like a social service, where you're, you know, you have hot water, you have cold water, you have ice. It's a spirit by itself. It doesn't, you know, I feel like we don't want to kind of dilute it to a certain extent so that you kind of lose the nuances.
There's
like
so there's, many variables that go into making soju, and it's so specific. And even adding a couple drops of water completely changes it. So I was just thinking to myself, trying to mix with it is...
We're going to lose
it's
it.
It's going to be really hard.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't want to say anything to take away, but I think mixing with it is going to be really difficult because it's already been diluted. It's already been crafted to be something really specific. I really think the best way for us to serve it is we have to figure out a way to make it special without messing with it too
kind
much.
Kind of preserve the inherent nature of what's in there.
So, like, maybe it's like a tableside service or something, you know, where, you know, you can bring over snacks that would, like, say, like sweet potato chips. I'm just throwing ideas out there.
Absolutely.
But, you know, some things that would really help you understand the flavor of it and support that flavor instead of, say, like, throwing it into like a, you know, a lemonade or a whiskey sour sort of cocktail, you know.
Yeah, we want
to keep it real.
Yeah.
Make it more accessible to the palate. You know, if you're introducing something that's like new to the public who doesn't really understand the style, or doesn't really like, if I'm going out to eat a Japanese cuisine and there's and it's not just like sushi, if there's a specific style that I'm going out for, like, how is that appropriate for what pairs nicely with what I'm eating? You know, that's the whole point of this, is like, we talk about how soju is totally meant and crafted to be consumed with your meal. So it's like the focus is intently there to be
consumed. It just tastes
with
better
food.
With food too.
Yeah.
So will you try to pair it with the food you cook at home?
We talked about this yesterday. We did a tasting where we kind of like thought about a line of different soju and how we would pair it with different foods. But I mean, you know, these umami flavors are very like, especially what we found with the barley and even sweet potato, is like we can pair it with a bunch of different foods because it lends itself due to the
kind of
the fatty
what,
or nutty
what you eat at home.
Yeah.
I mean, I make macaroni and cheese at home.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, and that's a really good hint into. I mean, I imagine you guys are actually doing that behind the bar as well too. Is what is this person going to like? A good window into what they might like is what does their diet like? What are they eating on a regular basis?
I mean, this is like really advanced talk. Right now, all we want to do is get people to start drinking it. I think it's difficult for Americans because it's lower ABV, so it's already not like it's not a party drink. It's a more sophisticated drink.
It's socializing.
For us, I'm not saying that I'm not a partier. I love to party, but it's not the party drink. It's like a little bit more sophisticated. You're gonna sit and think about it. It's like it's a quiet drink.
But I think that you know, for this particular thing, it is a good socializing thing, and I think that like for people that are having dinner parties, it would be a nice kind of social introduction to something that, you know, Western culture like has dinner parties and people come over and they bring food and your hosts pour wine for your friends and they drink wine or they drink, you know, cocktails or whatever. This is like definitely very easy. It could easily be introduced in that kind of setting. But you know, again, it's a we don't have any sort of knowledge about this. We don't know how it relates to, you know, something that's completely foreign to us, and then inserting it in what our Western day-to-day is like, for people, like, who, associate, what's that, you know? So
it's going to be tricky.
Yeah, that's very tricky.
We're just so, it's ingrained in us to just drink a whiskey and a beer.
It's one or the other. There's not a lot of middle ground there. Yeah. And we've switched up. We have two new entrants into the
double summit,
into the match. We're in. Why don't we, before we get started, why don't both you gentlemen tell everybody your name and why they should know you or where they could find you?
So my name's Mikey Enright. I'm based in Sydney in Australia. I own a couple of bars there, as well as various other projects that I work on. I'm keeping very busy over there, but it's great to be here. We've had an amazing tour.
And to his right?
So I'm Ryan Chathy-Wardner. I go by a moniker of Mr. Lion because my surname's really long and difficult. I'm a bartender based in London. I own a couple of cocktail bars out there. I have a little restaurant, and I have some books and projects and various different products. And essentially try and involve myself in every aspect of food and drink I can get myself involved in.
Very nice. And so that aspect, I said you guys are here on a shochu tour, but that aspect of food and drink, I think that's going to be something really important. What did you guys discover in the world of food and drink in relation to shochu? Were there any interesting discoveries this time around?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was more about getting to know the category. And, you know, it does seem like there is a ritual around that, and there's obviously, it pairs really well with food. I think for the Australian market, you probably want to look at more of a higher ABV for cocktail mixing. I think from my side, you kind of want it to be like almost like the base spirit of the drink to really get those characters through. However, I do feel that, you know, the cultural difference would be tough to get people to just kind of almost have it as a sipping drink throughout their meal.
Yeah. What about you, sir, Mr. Lyon?
Yeah, so I tend not to separate food and drink because, I mean, you eat, you end up drinking. If you drink, you end up eating. And, you know, a lot of the approach I think that all of us do as bartenders here is very similar to what happens in a kitchen. But you know, it's always really useful if you're trying to understand a product to be able to taste it in context and see how it relates to the culture around it. So being able to taste the foods, particularly going through different regions and seeing what the specialisms are, and it gives you a real window into the product. So it's been a really, you know, of course it's important for us to understand it from the distiller's perspective, from the regional perspective, but it was more about really understanding it from a cultural point of view, and seeing it alongside the food, tasting it, being with all of the distillers and their approach to what they think it goes well with. You know, that was really insightful, and it helped us understand, you know, why the flavor profiles are a particular way, why they approach the creation of the product in a particular way. And I think that's given us, you know, a huge amount more information than we could do kind of just sitting alone in our bars and tasting it. Of course, we can analyze it from a flavor point of view and understand how particularly we might mix it, but it's so much richer to be able to come here, see it, experience it, and talk to the people behind it, and then taste the food alongside it as well.
Have you had experience shochu before?
I tasted shochu, but again, only in an isolated way. So it was usually in a meal, but you were tasting one particular brand or product of shochu. So then being able to taste them in series. So not only were we able to go to somewhere like Iki Island, very specific, and taste a regional style, but also to kind of taste across the different kind of bases of them, and also the different distillers' approach to them, the different strengths, the different foods that they went alongside. So it was very different. It was a huge enlightenment to be able to taste the spectrum of them and to taste them across the different regions.
Yeah, I mean, same for me, really. It's kind of, I did a cocktail program for a Pan Southeast Asian bar back in 2003 in Australia, and the cocktail menu comprised of, you know, sake and soju, but we had no idea what we were doing, especially after this trip. But you know, we played with the flavors, and that was the concept that we had and stuff, and it worked. So this trip has been really insightful, like what Ryan said, in terms of like you're getting so much more information about, you know, A, the category, but also each distillery and each brand and what they're doing and how they're different as well. It was really enlightening. And you know, it's kind of made me quite excited about the category that I didn't really know very much about.
How often is it that you come across something that is so new? Is it the kind of the general consensus from everybody is that we realized how little we knew.
Yeah.
And that there was so much out there, and that there was so much depth and so much diversity and all these things there, and that here is this word that was in our lexicon, but we really realized we had little to no knowledge or experience with this. Is this something that you guys come across fairly regularly, or is this?
You know, you're absolutely right. We're very fortunate to be able to travel around the world and taste lots of different things. And of course, lots of places you go in the world, you're tasting something unique because it is a reflection of a culture that's very different. But there is so much that is hyper-specific to shochu that I've certainly not encountered. And, you know, it goes beyond the idea of it just being a cultural reflection. There is a different approach, a different methodology, a different set of ingredients here. So it was, you know, this is very unique, and I think that's the thing that we've really opened our eyes to, is not only the fact that these are an amazing product, but nobody in the world knows about this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of crazy, because as professionals, you try and expose yourself to a wide range of things, but it just really shows that there has been such difficulty in kind of getting under the skin of this category. You know, the transparency isn't there, and it's very difficult. You know, of course, there is a language barrier, and there is a difference in being able to really get to that information. But it's, you know, for something so unique, it's kind of shocking for us to kind of really see something that's kind of in its own category, and we've not really been exposed to.
Yes, and especially Japan's kind of in the spotlight, you know, culinary wise and everything, and
so hot right now.
Right. People are going out of their way to come here and
yeah.
You know, find things and look for things. And the shochu, it's been around for quite a while, and it's readily accessible.
Absolutely, and I think it's, you know, we've taken some of the lessons that are happening in the rest of the booze world at the moment. You know, there's a big push for the idea of transparency, more information, and that's reflective of what the consumer is after as well. But they're also after new experiences, new flavors, and this is something that kind of could offer both. You know, it's something really different, and it's just, I suppose it's a bit of now our duty, having experienced that, to kind of take that information out there. But it'll be exciting to see how those kind of barriers around it break down, and people can start to, a wider group of people can start to discover this as well. Sorry.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think I work a lot in the gin category back in Australia, and travel to a lot of gin distilleries and whiskey distilleries, and to come across, you know, to experience what we've just experienced was pretty incredible. And it will be interesting to see what happens with the category, you know, globally, to see whether it can, you know, start to shine and basically have some awareness around it, really, because nobody really seems to know really quite what it is. I spoke to Ryan, and there's a bar in London that opened a very long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, called Soshu Lounge, which was underneath Roku, which is a brilliant restaurant, I think in Soho.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they had a Soshu bar, and that was the first time I'd heard about the category way back then. But, you know, we don't really know what they were doing with, you know, with Soshu then, and to the complexity of what it is. I think it was more around infusions and basic cocktails, I think. But, you know, it was, you know, way ahead of its time, and it'd be great to see the category, you know, expanding and get some awareness, but like main education stuff. It is quite hard because it is, you know, we've just had a kind of almost like a brain dump over the last week from all the distillers. But, you know, yeah, it's kind of, you know, how we can translate that on to the customer, but also obviously our teams and bartenders, and explain how it's made and why it's so different, and the cultural side too.
Was there anything in particular that kind of a light kind of clicked on, or something, a key word that you were like, ooh, there might be something here. I feel like, or you were talking about like that transparency when it comes to communicating back home. Was there anything that you felt like, this is the type of thing that I think people can latch onto, or this is the type of thing that I can?
I think the real difficulty is there is several of those. It's not like there is one key distinction. There is lots. You know, of course, there is the pre-sacrification with Koji. That's very unique. But I think it goes beyond that. You know, that's actually an easy way in, I think, because, you know, what you were saying before about, particularly from a culinary perspective, there's a lot of focus on the Japanese techniques with around food and the use of Koji. So that will help. It's an anchor. It's something that people can go, okay, I've heard that word and I understand a bit about that. But then it's just peeling off layers of the onion of it. So there's so much more to kind of delve into. And then there's such a widespread of different styles that it unfortunately isn't as simple as just being going, oh, this is the bit of information, this is the nugget that will help get it past the line. I think it's, you know, it needs to be a much more kind of, concerted, like kind of rounder effort to try and be able to kind of bring that to the public.
What about food pairing in your world in London?
As I said before, we try and do a bit of stuff where we blur the boundaries a bit. So, you know, I think we always try and do it where it's not necessarily trying to sync the two up, because I think that can be quite difficult. And what we try and do is co-create the dish and the drink and the experience and how that sits at a particular time in the meal. But I think there are so many unique textures, flavors, and particularly the ABV is helpful in a kind of food setting. But there are so many opportunities for us, you know, that's, you know, we have a very small space that allows us to have that experience for people. But I think there is a huge amount that could be done, because it offers this, you know, there is this savory aspect to the profile of it that I think will give a lot of opportunity. But I think being able to create a few simple serves around particular styles that will help people think about when they can enjoy it, because I think it works great with the cuisine here, but you want to show that it can work across a variety of different cuisines. And I think being able to anchor it at a particular point in the meal, so this works with savory, grilled style dishes or something like that, something a little bit easier and a bit more universal, along with, and then you serve it either over ice or with this tea or something like that, something that's very simple, will help people be able to then contextualize it so they can then start to add in their own kind of modifications to suit their palate and stuff.
I mean, in Sydney, in Australia in general, it does have a huge Asian population. So the cuisines, you know, pan across, you know, all across Asia. So I think you've got to try and take it from traditional Japanese to like more contemporary Japanese sort of style in terms of the cuisine. I think that to me would work. I think it would be quite tough to get people to go to sushi as opposed to drinking sake with their food. So a lot of education would have to be done around that. And there's a lot of work, I think, to be done. But I do think from the cocktail food matching kind of thing, which is relatively popular over there, there's definitely something there where you could entry them in there. Like, hey, don't just drink this neat or over ice, but hey, it's in this drink. And I think that would create quite a bit of awareness to, I think, the consumer and the guests in Australia. I think that would be the angle that I would take personally, to sort of like get it out there about the category and what it is.
Last thing, what could we do to make your guys' life easier? So here in Japan, whether it's the brewers, whether it's the people on the education side, where it's the people who have connections, what could we do to make your life, to help with that transparency or to help get you the types of things you're looking for?
Because there was something that we were discussing when we were tasting this, and I think, you know, a lot of the time the information stems from the very traditional aspect of it. So it is a barley shochu aged for this amount of time from this region. And that's great, and it is important, and it helps explain to people that there is that regionality. but every distiller does something different. So we need to know, why does this taste the way it does? What can we do to source it for the guest to be able to contextualize those flavors? And being able to know that they use this particular koji, they do it for this period of time, this is what is specific to them, and this is why these flavors are there in this particular barley or rice or sweet potato shochu. And so I think that resource where the educators are working alongside the distillers to kind of give a real kind of insight to what they're doing, that will help hugely.
And so there you have it. That puts our special shochu interview session, that brings it to a close. Sebastian, thank you again so much.
I mean, it's been really interesting to listen to these people on the front line of cocktails and mixology. And I mean, great experience for us as well.
It was really insightful. I said, I think what we were just talking a moment ago, sort of what the producers are hoping for from their shochu and how they'd like to see it enjoyed. Sometimes, right, what the producer is envisioning here isn't always how it translates overseas and how people pick up on it and how people use it. And in an interesting and exciting way, I feel like maybe what the producers anticipated, right, bringing over mixologists, they're looking at, obviously, how do we factor these things into these different cocktails and whatnot. But maybe that isn't the end game or the solution that we're going for. There was a major focus on food. A lot of the things that the producers and a lot of the local people tout as being the really amazing parts of shochu and what really makes it special, what was really neat to hear was that that's what a lot of the people got out of the experience. That's what they really discovered and what they really want to bring back and find a way to introduce.
Yeah, and they want to introduce shochu as it is and not as a component in something else.
Right, without having to doctor it up too much into, you know, stripping away all of the nuance and everything that makes it special and exciting. So it will be exciting to see what all of these talented gentlemen come up with.
Next up, we have Mr. Sylvain Huet, sake samurai and organizer of Salon du Sake in Paris. He's joining us for just a brief chat during his recent visit to Japan. Enjoy.
Sylvain, welcome to the show.
Hello, Justin. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
I say, we're really happy to have you. I said, we're having a lot of fun here, and so we're really excited to have you here. You've been having a lot of fun lately. Maybe too much fun.
No, there's not such thing as too much fun and too much sake talks and sake events or things. So on the body, sometimes it can be a little hard, especially the traveling part. But yeah, for the past 5 years, actually I've been organizing what is probably today the largest sake event outside of Japan. It's called Salon du Sake.
Yeah.
It's a sake fair that is open to general public and professionals. And this year we had like almost 5,000 visitors over 3 days of fair. We had almost 500 different types of sake for the visitors to taste. We had 65 or 66% of professional visitors, lots of new visitors from 42 different countries, and we're doing, of course, we have all the exhibitors. 7 prefectures participated by themselves or with the Shuzoku Miyai, and we had like 74 exhibitors. So yeah, it's every year it's growing, it's getting even more international. It is the European fair for sake and Japanese products. Main is of course about Japanese sake, but we also have some beer or some Japan wine and some Japan whiskey is very trendy also abroad.
Absolutely. So very good. I want to hear a lot more about Salon du Sake. Before we jump into that, for our listeners, so Sylvain Huet is, as you probably gathered, the producer, organizer, and master of ceremonies for everything Salon du Sake, as well as just about the entire world of sake in and around France these days. If the word sake and the word France come up together, generally your name is attached in some way, shape, or form. So how should our listeners know you? What is keeping you busy these days?
Well, first of all, I'm such a big fan of sake. I discovered sake the first time, Japanese sake, the first time I came to Japan about 20 years ago. Felt in love with the beverage. And it started just as a shumi, as a leisure. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to have my friend learn more. Actually, at that time, I was a practitioner of Aikido, which is a Japanese martial art that got me into Japan, and most of my Aikido friends, and I was a professional dancer at that time as well, most of my friends, they were they knew wine very well. I didn't come from a sommelier wine background, but they teach me about wine, and I wanted to teach them about sake. So far it started as learning by myself and having my friend sharing it. And from a group of friends to their friends to their friends of their friends, it became all over France and now all over Europe for the past 10 to 15 years that I've been doing that professionally.
A lot of people probably associate you with, as you're mentioning, Salon de Sake. So this is an event that has been going now for 5-6 years?
Actually, yes. We started that in 2013. Okay. in Paris for the first time. And then the following year, we took a year off to find a new location. And since 2014, we've been doing that every year. Now it's always like beginning of October. September is very full with wine and other beverage events in France. And of course, October, most brewers are starting to brew. Yeah. So we're trying to have it very beginning of the month. And it's been growing. From the first time, I wanted that event to be a European scale event, because I knew that even though the French market recently has increased a lot and quite fast, but I know that the French market or any European market is quite small, and it takes a lot from the brewers to come to from Japan to France or Europe for the first time. So from the first event, it was a European scale event. But now it's getting even more international. This year we had, as I mentioned, I think visitors from 42 different countries.
That's excellent that your original intent was to make something that was of European scale, that wasn't just specifically necessarily for the French market, but having that on an international scale. What have you been sort of keeping in mind each year as you adapt it and change it as the market grows and as things change?
Yeah, well, there were like two main goals for me for Salon du Sake, and that was from the beginning and still is. First, maybe not everybody knows that, but in France, but all over Europe, it's the same. The word sake is associated with Baijiu, with a spirit offered at the end of the meal. Even in most cheap sushi place, which are usually not Japanese owned, but maybe owned by Chinese or Korean people, which they offer at the end of the meal something that they call sake, please have sake, to thank their customers. So they don't charge for that. Usually it's not Japanese sake. So one of the most difficult thing to have people try sake in France, but it's not only in France, it's all over Europe, is to have them understand that it is not the drink that they think. Most people say, oh, I've had sake, it's too strong, thank you, no worry, I don't want it. But once they start drinking real Japanese sake, they enter a new world. So basically changing this image of the word sake and having people understand that Japanese sake or Nihonshu is the real thing that they have to discover has been one of the main goals of Salon du Sake. Putting together such a great large event that even the press, the journalists, not only the drink specialist journalists, but also the general media, since the first event up until now, they've been talking more and more about sake. The other idea, the goal is to open the market for the brewers. I don't import sake myself, which over the years has allowed me to have good relationship with all the major actors, all the major importers. And since I don't compete with them, it's easy for me to have them participate in Salon du Sake.
It's important to have that neutral figure in there.
Yes, I'm trying so far that because I love sake from all over Japan. And the part of Salon du Sake is introducing off-world the sake that you can already find in France or in Europe, but also many new sake that want to reach Europe. And for that, we've been doing many different things. First, the increase of professional visitors is very important. And recently, we've had that many, the wine shop dealers in France are very important. French people buy wine at the wine fair or the department stores. First, they go visit the local wine shop dealers for advices, for tasting. And I'm pretty sure that once the wine shop dealers in France get a grab and sake and can start promoting sake, the market will evolve even more quickly than it is. But also we had lots of buyers from restaurants, from department stores, from all kind of business that deal with sake, and this is very important. But the one thing that we have been evolving the most is Salon du Sake is a tasting event. So we have, this year we had 74-75 from the just one table, one brewer introducing his own sake to large Hyogo prefecture, what the guest offer, for example, this year's very much larger, or Saga prefecture or Miya prefecture came with a lot of brewers to introduce their sake. But also we do lots of events, like lectures, can be about the general culture, can be about specific topics, like what is Kimoto, or what is Yamahai sake. sake. This year we focus on kanzake, hot sake, because French people, they don't know much about hot sake. Of course, they like sake that is close to what they know, which is wine, like fruity, the type of sake you drink in a wine glass. But since I don't want sake and wine to compete, I want them to be very complementary. I always try to promote and explain how sake can be different from wine. And one of the ways to play with sake in a way that you cannot with wine is to play with temperatures. And I think for the chefs or the sommelier, being able to offer a drink at the same temperature of a cold plate, or even colder or a little warmer, or a hot plate with the same temperature or warmer or colder, is something that is amazing, that brings so much flavors, new flavors into the food, gets the umami being discovered in a way that cannot really with wine. It's something that we want to explain to people. But once again, French people think of hot wine, which usually is not good wine. You want to drink that only to get warmer in the cold season, and we add ginger and sugar. So that has a very bad image. And kanzake, even people from my staff who haven't been to Japan yet, they don't get what is hot sake. So we do try to focus a lot. We have lots of panel discussions about sake being made outside of Japan, or how the sakaya-san, like the wine shop dealers, or the restaurants can get sake and can introduce sake to their customers. And also, one of the most trendy part of Salon du Sake consists of what we call pairing workshops. For 1 hour, we try to pick a theme, and this year we had like very different things. One was sake and oyster, so we had some chef, Japanese chef or French chef, making a recipe out of one sake that I gave to them in order to pair it with oysters, or just try different type of oyster with different sake. Also, French bistronomy is very rediscovering itself, and recently we had like the very traditional, simple bistro food that has become trendy again, and we tried to pair that kind of food with Japanese sake, and it was wonderful. All the chefs work in a way that was at the same time very traditional, bringing the traditional taste of those traditional recipes, but in a very modern way, associating with sake.
I said that business focus that you're talking about, that's really interesting. I think that's going to be a really important side, it's an amazing opportunity for the casual consumer to come and try a lot of different sake. As you were mentioning, there are people in different areas of the market that have a large role to play in helping communicate and educate, and an ongoing theme that seems to keep coming up on this show is the need to also re-educate, is that there has been a lot of education and experience
there's
that has happened.
Different levels,
yeah. And so we actually have to get back, break down some of the preconceptions and build those back up again, whether it be with how sake is typically served, as you said, at the end of the meal, or what is warm sake? How does that, what is the potential in something like that? Having to sort of change people's perceptions. Who do you think has an interesting role to kind of play in bringing sake and introducing those new opportunities and experiences? You're talking about, wine merchants and sellers and things like that.
Yeah, the one thing that once again is connected to the fact that the word sake is used for something that is not Japanese sake makes that, in America, the sushi boom, all over the world as well, brought together is a kind of a sake boom. In France, in Europe, that's the opposite. The sushi boom made a bad image for what is people know as sake. For that reason, most of the Japanese restaurants, of course, are introducing sake the best as they can do. But so far, the Western food restaurants, the French food or the fusion restaurants or the wine sommelier, may have been the people to promote sake the best way to introduce it to those customers. And in terms of that, the wine market is a very mature one, the restaurant market as well, even though it's always like new restaurant opening. And for example, in Paris, we have a lot of young, fabulous Japanese chefs who are getting a Michelin star to their restaurants, and they don't cook any Japanese food. They make French food. And one of them, we give them a carte blanche for a specific workshop at Salon du Sake. And that was amazing, because even though he's making French food, of course, his sensibility comes from various experiences that he has both in Japan and in Europe. And he's also using some of the Japanese ingredients. But in terms of introducing sake, I think every single layer of the business should do their part. We talked about the sakeyasan, the wine shop dealers that should be able to introduce and explain what is sake to their own customers. Being the salespeople of distributors, being able to explain to the sommelier, to the chef, to the grocery stores, not only what sake they have and how can they introduce those products to their own customers. Being also the sommelier in the restaurants or the chefs. And there's a huge lack of education. I mostly do education besides organizing events, and not only like large events such as Salon Sake, but much smaller scale events like private events or general events. But education is something that I think will make a difference. And that's why 20 years ago when I started educating people about sake, I never really considered importing myself or selling myself. I thought in order to develop the market, first, education should be the first brick to build that world. So nowadays, many people are doing education. Even the distributors or the salespeople are doing their kind of education. And when the brewers come to such an event, they do educate the consumers as well. But I strongly believe in independent education so that people can make their own choice. I don't think that we should drink sake the way Japanese people drink it. I don't think we should drink it the way American people drinking or other European countries, Northern Europe. And we do have our own cultural trends, but also everyone is independent. So for me, everyone should make sake their own, not only in the one they pair it with food for the professionals, but how they drink it at home. Do they drink it in a wine glass, or do they prefer ochoko? Do they drink it cold? Do they like very light and fruity sake, or do they prefer more full body sake? And for that, there is not one answer. And I think part of the way to enlarge the market is to have as many people try as many sake as they can and make their own choices of sake. And that's what I've been doing, and what Salon du Sake is a great tool to do, educating not only the general public but the professionals as well.
Excellent. You mentioned that idea of education. A lot of things, I think these different markets, these international markets, they're going to grow very organically, I think, over time, as to, you know, how does sake fit into this world, whether it be in France, whether it be in Italy, whether it be in the U.S. It's something that, you know, through the work of all the people that you're talking about, was probably something that will ideally grow very organically and become something that is, you know, unique in each of those territories.
Yes. Of course, like brewers and organizations such as JSS or JETRO or some others have some goals to introduce sake towards the world and to different markets, France, and others, European countries as well. But there's some kind of natural growth that can come from people being interested in sake itself or into Japanese drinks. I think I mentioned that Japanese whiskey, for example, is very trendy, and like for the wine shop dealers, they often have customers not coming for Japanese sake, but coming for Japanese whiskey, and then they can start explaining to them. But we also have other Japanese products. Have you ever tried Japanese sake? To which they say, yes, I have, no thanks. And then we have to explain that, no, that's not what you think, please try it. But also like the organic wine market also is trying to get some different type of sake into the market. Also the Japanese restaurants are trying to get more and more sake, but as I mentioned, either the very expensive, trendy 2 or 3 Michelin star restaurants, the palace hotels also have sake at the bars or on the menu. But as I mentioned before, even the simpler bistro type are starting to have sake pairing. So through many different ways, and I think at Salon du Sake, if we look at the visitors that we have, we find all those kind of people. Some have been traveling to Japan and they want to get back in touch with what they discovered during their trip, so they want to meet the people and taste Japanese sake. Some others are more, they don't really care about Japanese sake itself. They're more interested into the new trends, for like many journalists coming to Salon du Sake. So far, they may or may not have not experienced what is rich Japanese sake, but they just want to try new tests, new trends, and then talk about those. So there are many different levels, many different ways, and as I mentioned, for the general public, they should make sake their own. I think all different aspects of the market should make sake their own. Of course, some ways are better than some others. I think that when people try to explain that if they like wine, they will like sake. It's true, but very often to counterfeit the bad image of the bad use of the word sake for spirits, they say sake is like wine. You like wine and you like sake. But sometimes it builds sake to getting into some competition with wine, which I think it's not the best way because, well, French people, they love their wines.
Yeah.
And they drink mostly French wine. So if we put sake in competition with wine, we know who will win.
It's kind of always going to be a footnote on the bottom of the...
Yes, exactly. So I often explain people, if people are looking into sake only what they like into wines, basically they want to drink wine. So they will find the kind of sake that looks is very close to wine, fruity. They might like acidity or they might think sake is a little too sweet for them. But they will find those kinds. But sake is not only that. We have sake that has almost no aromas, that is very good, the type that you can drink room temperature or hot. Some sake is more full body. And so having people understanding that sake can be close to wine, but also can be very different, is also a very important part of getting into all the layers of the consumers and the professional markets.
That's a really big challenge, and I think a really important one, and that the idea of the wine world has tons of lots and lots of amazing people and amazing organizations doing lots of work and can lend so much support and advice, and there's so many opportunities to grow sake through wine. But as you say, at the end of the day, sake or Nihonshu has to stand on its own as its own entity in order for it to really, really grow. Do you think we're getting there? Because I think that that's something that's been a challenge for a while, and that at first you just have to get people to try it, right? You need to first get that headway, but at some point the table needs to turn and we have to go from, look, it's something you don't know, just give it a try, to actually it is something that has this huge, that is just full of depth and possibility and is something really special that can truly stand on its own. And are we getting there? Is France?
It's there already. The thing is, how many people?
Yeah.
That's because many people, like I'm not the only one, comes to Japan, they discover Japanese sake and they have their own experience. I don't pretend to know it all or that my choice of sake are better than some others. Like I've been involved in some sake contests for the first time, which was very interesting. But, you know, putting grades on sake and saying this is the best one, or it's very odd to me because one sake that is good for me might not be your favorite and you might find this one much better or depending on the type of your parents. But in terms of having people discovering sake by itself, it's there and not there. As I mentioned, the first step we have to find, and I've been dealing that with more than 15 years, every time I try a seminar or lecture, I have to explain not what is sake, but what sake is not. I have to start explaining that it's not a spirit. It's not a digestive that you eat at the end of the meal. It's not 40 or 50 degrees alcohol. It's not a distilled spirit, a distilled drink. So in order to get that, I understand that people are trying to explain that it's very close to wine. But then again, the wine people, the sommelier people, their amazing knowledge of wine helps a lot with introducing sake. But sometimes it's not enough because they only interpret sake through their knowledge of wine. And I don't come from a wine background. I have never studied wine. And I'm lucky enough to study with the best sommelier. They introduce the great wines to me and introduce the sake to them. But there are many other ways. So if we look at 5 years before now, or 10 years, the market has changed a lot. As I mentioned, the wine shop dealers that were waiting for, the month I will have like 10 customers asking me for Japanese sake, I will consider bringing it into my shop. Now, most of them, they're either considering starting or thinking, should I try having sake, those kind of things. And in the past, they may have tried, but because of the market was not there yet, it may have been difficult, so they decide not to move on with it. But things are changing, because people are demanding to try new products. They are demanding to try Japanese sake when they know what it is. And some people also are trying to discover sake that is very different from wine that they drink on every day. Some others, they just want to find the same pleasure with sake that with wine, and it's perfectly fine. Most of sake being sold, being trendy outside of Japan, even in Japan for the past 40 years, or like Ginjo type of sake that is very fruity and very approachable, very easy to get with. And so, as I said, again, there is not one way, very different type of customers, very different networks to do sales, to do distribution. And that's why at Salon Sake or through education courses or through other events, we're trying first to get people to try it by itself. And then some people want geeky explanation. They want to know how it is made, and they want to know all about the Tokutei Meisoshu or the Ginjo Daino. Some other people, they may just want, who's making that? How long have they been making it? Oh, really, they're in the campaign, and it's, oh, that's the first women making sake in that region. Those kind of stories touch people sometimes even more than the technical explanation. So it's a world made of many different type of people, many different type of restaurants or distributors, and we should find different sakes and different ways to explain sake for all of them.
Right, it's very, the market is very multi-layered and diverse, and as is sake,
which makes it very interesting.
Which is what makes it fun.
And
right?
I don't want sake to be just a new trend, and then they will switch to the new drinks after that. So rather going too quickly, strongly, step by step, moving on to the next one is what is happening, and I'm very happy about it.
I said, I think that's what kind of what makes wine, that makes craft beer and whiskey and these other things really interesting and exciting as well, is the fact that you can grasp enough to know that you can't know everything. Hmm. And that's kind of what makes it fun and appealing, I feel like, is that you taste and you try and you experience enough to realize, I'm never going to know all about this. And that kind of propels people to want to learn more. And I think people are starting to realize that sake has all of those elements and maybe more in some ways.
And again, they come from a point of view where for them, there's only one sake, like the one that usually they're drinking. There's a picture of a nude person in the choco that's what the thing. So starting from there and thinking it's not a spirit, it's not a distilled drink. There's more than one. There's 10, 20, and we had 500 different at Salon du Sake, but no, there are way more in Japan to be discovered. It takes a lot of time for people to discover that, and then they got lost. They said, oh my God, I cannot eat all. So some people, that might be scary. So that's why bringing, like doing pairing workshops or doing thematic discoveries or doing, like we had a great event at a movie festival, and it was like Japanese movie, and some people came from the mangas and some from the more traditional movies. Those people, they might not get interested into sake at the first place, but drinking a little bit by little and discovering makes them not an intellectual drink, but a pleasurable drink, something that they drink only because they enjoy it. And when they want to start learning about it, they might find many different ways to do it.
Lastly, I said we sort of touched on the idea of education, and you talked about all the different professional workshops and things you did with Salon du Sake this year. Was there any particular educational event or experience or something that you felt really stood out that either resonated with the professionals that you were working with or with those that were, or the casual consumers that were there experiencing it? Was there anything that really was like, wow, this is really eye-opening? And then just right now, while you were in Japan, was there anything that really stood out to you that was really exciting? Or is there anything back in France that has you really excited at the moment?
Well, one of the themes for pairings was oyster and sake. And as you may or may not know, like French people, when they eat fish, they eat cooked. And Japanese people, they eat cooked fish, but mostly like sushi or sashimi, they eat raw. But for oysters, that's the opposite. Most French people, they eat namagaki, like raw oyster. Yeah. And in Japan, oysters, they can have nama, but raw, when they say it, so when it's raw, usually it's more like cooked or that way. And we had that pairing theme with oyster. Why? Because in France, it's a lot of oysters. People love it. And even people who don't like oysters started to like it when it was paired with sake. So not only doing that kind of educational experience makes people understand that, oh, sake is good, but also it transforms the way they can have food. And as I mentioned, again, some people, myself including, when I was a kid, I didn't like oysters. It's only when I came to Japan that I started eating oyster, and pairing it with sake makes it even better to me. And we had a chance to work with one of the best oyster farm from Bretagne, where my father was born, so I'm half French Briton, which made me very prude. But yes, those kind of very simple. Also, one thing that we do very often is pairing cheese with sake, and wine and cheese is very important for French people, but having them understand that sake works very well with cheese also opens a new realm of possibility for them. In terms of, you don't even have to cook. You can just buy some cheese and have a bottle of sake with friends at home. And for the wine shop dealers, they can explain that to the customers. They can do it at the shop itself. And with the order, it's the same. So it's very easy, because most people think, oh, now I like sake, but I don't cook Japanese, and then I cannot bring it back home. That's the opposite. People should understand that there are many ways to do it. And the other part of your question was in Japan. Well, I was lucky enough to be hired by a Belgian company that has been doing wine and beer and spirit contests for more than 25 years. But this year they wanted to get involved with sake. And they had a great partner with the Mie Prefecture. And they started what is called Sake Selection. It's a new international contest. We had 35 judges from 19 different countries. I was hired as the international sake expert because, of course, that Belgium company has little knowledge of sake. But also, I had to do the testing sheets. And half of the judges came from media, wine, and other worlds, and half of the others were like more like sake specialists. That's, so having to work with different type of people in order to help them understanding and finding their own way to taste sake and in a contest, and then bring that back to their own country and talk about sake in a new way, that was very, very interesting. Not only meeting the people, but also testing. We had more than 600 sake for that first contest. That was very, in terms of human experience, having many different kind of people, a little like salon sake, but salon sake people come to enjoy themselves, to learn by themselves. Here, there was a group of people that has a unique goal together, that was finding with it a selection of sake, the one that would have maybe not the best sake. I don't think a competition should be about finding which is the best one, but it was like finding the one that might have the best chances overseas. And that's the way I made the testing sheets, and that's the way we organized the contest, to select some sake out of a huge selection to help them finding the new market. And it's all about, very important, because you know sake consumption has been declining in Japan, and every year some great brewers might end making sake, and we really want to help all those people to find a way to sell sake in order to keep making, to keep protecting that traditional art of making sake. And competition are part of that, and I'm happy that there are new international or local country by country competitions that can help the brewers to find new markets.
That's wonderful. I would love to hear more about how you put that together and how that worked
that
out.
That was also quite a challenge.
I can imagine. It's in that tasting sheet. And I think that's important, is right, setting different types of standards and different ways of evaluating not just the value, but the potential for sake. And I think that sounds like a great opportunity. Sylvan, I know you have to run. I know you have some place
so
to be.
So sorry for that. We can probably meet some other time, and I'll be very happy to be here. You're most welcome to come to Salon de Sake Nature's and to do a live show or something. I would love it. And for people listening to that show, if I may announce that Salon de Sake already, we decided the dates. Next year is going to be October 5, 6, and 7th. It's Saturday, Sunday, and Monday event. And you're most welcome. You can find out Salon de Sake, salon-sake. You just Google it, Salon de Sake, and there's only one that scales. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on, and we will have you back on again once you're on the island. We'll dig into more of these.
Yes,
and
please.
It's set. Sake on Air next year, live at Salon de Sake.
And yes, good luck with Sake on Air. Thank you so much.
It's great having you in the studio. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
And with that, we wrap up another episode of Sake on Air. I hope that you enjoyed what you heard this time around. If you did or didn't and would like to share your thoughts, please feel free to mail us at questions@sakeonair.com. We would love your feedback, questions, and show ideas. You can also message us and track our adventures on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at @sakeonair. If you have a moment, a kind review on the Apple or Google Podcast Store, or whatever service it is that you're listening to this on, would be greatly appreciated as well. A big thanks is in order to the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association for helping to make this show possible, as well as to Export Japan and our man behind the boards, Mr. Frank Walter, for all of the great production support. We will be back again in 2 weeks with another episode of Sake on Air, broadcast from the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center in Tokyo. Until then, kanpai!